Hello, Internet friend. I'm David Revell, and this is ValueSide for Wednesday, August 16. For all of our articles and podcasts, visit ValueSide.com. Well, today, how weaponized reform is at the heart of much of our corruption. Well, the rot in America is palpable. It oozes from the halls of our schools, drips like rancid water from the floors of Washington, and destroys the unworthy. In our uniquely American version of reform, there is an implied moral component that allows its promoters to accumulate power for themselves. Under the reform banner, the United States has been transformed from a nation designed to restrain central power to likely the most concentrated control mechanism of all time. You may have already run afoul of this monster on the Potomac, this leviathan that has taken control of nearly every aspect of our lives, from taxes to laws to regulations. The federal government will likely have something to say about almost everything you'd like to do, and the great irony is that it has become the very antithesis of its name. The issue here revolves around the concept of a federal government. Federalism was the central concept around which our founding fathers established the government. It was the method of those founding fathers that used to restrain central government control by creating a series of different governments at the local, state, and national level, each with its own distinct authority, provided limits to the concentration of power at the central level. The most succinct description of what Americans' founders were trying to accomplish was described by the Catholic historian John Emmerich Edward Dalberg Acton, or simply Lord Acton. He was a friend of such notables as UK Prime Minister Gladstone and perhaps the most significant American historian of his time, Alexis de Tocqueville. Acton was a great admirer of the U.S. system of government and saw this system of limited central government power as the best method to preserve liberty. After all, Acton said, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Acton saw that this American federalism, which provided for only limited government power at the national level, would have most significant political decisions made by the states and local levels. Federalism was designed to prevent the concentration of power in that central authority, like a monarch or a king. Instead, as much as was possible, power and authority were granted to the people, and the local governments were instituted to disperse authority. I'm reminded of this goal of federalism every time I drive out of my house. Down the street is an old one-room schoolhouse, the kind that dot this part of Pennsylvania. My neighborhood was settled shortly after the country's founding, when iron ore was discovered here. It was in the early 19th century when dozens of little towns and villages sprung up. The perfect place for a dispersed government, for federalism. Each locality had its own schoolhouse. Schools were built by the local settlers, reflecting their pride in their new community. Not only did these new Americans build the school, they hired the teacher, or conducted classes themselves, set up the curriculum, provided the budget, and maintained the facility. Today, most of these former schools have been converted into private homes, each as lovingly cared for as before. Here was federalism at its finest. Local schools run by and provided for by the nearby citizenry. Now, a century and a half later, when I entered elementary school, that's exactly how things still worked in our country. Although sleek new buildings had replaced the one-room schoolhouses, still, education was a local affair. The local school board set the curriculum, determined which textbooks to use, and collected the taxes used to operate the school. My mother was even on the local PTA, the Parent Teachers Association, and there was a real sense that the school board and school administration were anxious to implement many of the PTA's recommendations. Federalism still held sway in America of the 1960s. And it was working. By the mid-1960s, the country had achieved the highest standardized SAT scores ever. However, our education system was about to change. 10 years before, in 1954, there came a Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education. And without going too far afield, this decision overturned an earlier decision, Plessy versus Ferguson, which provided for separate schools for different races, or in other words, provided segregation. Now, the Supreme Court was reforming our education system. No longer was separate but equal to be permitted. Schools would henceforth be integrated. The country saw this as a positive reform. And as is often the case, it wasn't the initial reform that has been the issue. It's what the federal government does following that initial reform that becomes problematic. Now, the fact that this took place in the Deep South is essential in appreciating the dynamic. The South had been the center of segregation since the Civil War. And this dispute revolved around the schools in Little Rock, Arkansas, home of future President Bill Clinton. Although many schools in the South did comply and open their doors for their new black students, the governor of Arkansas, Orville Faubus, refused, openly defying the Supreme Court's ruling to integrate. U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower was in a difficult position. He could not allow a state governor to outright defy the highest legal authority in the country. So in the end, Eisenhower ordered the U.S. Army's 101st Airborne to Little Rock and provided safe passages to the new black students. I believe that Eisenhower did the right thing, the moral thing. It was reform, as reform should be done. But our federal government received the wrong message. To the government bureaucrats in Washington, the Supreme Court's decision implied that local control of education should be severely limited. This was the first step in the federal government becoming the ultimate education authority. Yes, local school boards would still administer their schools, but only within the framework and constraint of the federal government. The nation's citizens could not be trusted to have complete control over their schools. And little by little, the federal government has been removing the initiatives and authorities of the local citizens to run their child's education. Although the U.S. Department of Education has assiduously avoided directly mandating school curriculum, still left to the states, they do have four principal objectives: financial aid, data and research, and focus on key issues and ensuring equal access. Now, perhaps the most visible recent reform, quote-unquote, has been the new interpretation of sex-based discrimination and a prime example of this new weaponized reform. Reform that no longer reflects the norms and values of a majority of Americans. Now, the 1972 Education Amendment to the Civil Rights Act of 64, known simply as Title IX, prohibits discrimination based on sex. Recently, the Biden administration has defined one's sex to include the broadest range of gender options. So today, according to the federal government, there is a literal alphabet of new sexes. Because Title IX enforcement now comes under the purview of the federal government, they can prohibit any discrimination across this new spectrum of sexual behavior. And just like that, we have the all-new story hours for our prepubescent children, in which sexual provocateurs display their genitalia along with Hansel and Gretel. Now, do you think most American parents approve of this behavior? Or put another way, do you think that if schools were still controlled locally, their curriculum would include providing sexual provocateurs close contact with elementary-age students? It's all a stunning example of how reform has been weaponized. What began as a noble cause. And that's the value side for Wednesday, August 16. For all of our articles and podcasts, visit valueside.com. I'm David Revelle. ValueSide is independently written and researched. The views expressed are strictly my own.